It's time for What's Up with Steve Abel from the Green Party.
Morena, Steve.
Morena, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you. Loud and clear, mate, loud and clear. Now, a couple of topics this morning. We're going to start with the gene tech bill, which is currently in the hearing stage, correct?
Yeah, we've got one more batch of hearings, I think, and then we're into deliberation at the Select Committee.
Okay, now, what have you observed during these hearings? Have you heard anything from the farmers and or also regenerative farmers about how this could affect Aotearoa's GMO-free status? Because obviously that is on the line, and that has been quite a strong selling point for us as a country, being GMO-free.
Yeah, it's a really interesting turn of events, because whilst this government has touted GMOs as some sort of silver bullet solution to all of our challenges in terms of climate change, it turns out that the primary production sector, including the big sector groups, you know, the dairy industry sector groups, Dairy New Zealand and the Dairy Companies Association and Fonterra and Beef and Lamb and Horticulture New Zealand and Seafood Industry and the wine growers, all of them are significantly trepidatious about losing that GMO-free status or the risk to our trade and market access of releasing genetically modified plants or animals into our agricultural systems. So the overwhelming message we've seen at the Select Committee is whilst those industry groups support some sort of reform of the current legislation, they're very anxious and, you know, concerned and calling a bit of a tai hoa on the kind of rapid release, the rushed nature of the process. A lot of the farmer groups, Dairy New Zealand in particular, really gave the government a bit of a serve, saying we didn't have time to consult with our farmers. You know, the six-week submission process.
Six-week submissions process on this. Wow.
That's Christmas, yeah.
Well, goodness me, that's such a short window. I mean, New Zealand's clean green brand has long been a selling point for our agricultural exports. Have the farmers put forward farmers or industry groups presented any potential economic consequences of introducing GMOs into production? What are they concerned about?
One of the things that you might find stunning, which I certainly did, was the lack of actual evaluation of the value of that clean green reputation and what impact GMOs might have on it. We know there is reputational risk. Everyone acknowledges that genetically modified food is not popular. We are highly dependent on export markets, exceptionally dependent for, you know, developing nations. As the dairy companies pointed out, like 95% of dairy, of beef and lamb, of wine, of a large section of horticulture is exported to like 120 different markets. So sensitivity is a big issue for us in terms of our access. But what they're sort of saying loud and clear is that there is uncertainty about what the actual economic value of that is. The only substantial report done was commissioned by the organics industry, but they commissioned the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research to do it. And they came back and said the risk could be as much as $10 to $20 billion lost annually from our export markets, which is extraordinary when you think about the scale of that. And where is the substantial economic analysis? It hasn't been done.
Crazy. Well, supporters of gene editing argue that it could improve crop resilience and sustainability. Are there any areas of common ground between regenerative farmers in general and those advocating for more biotech in agriculture?
Yes, the interesting thing is we see from the farm production sector, the likes of beef and lamb, what they're more interested in is the potential to deal with pest species, perhaps, or to deal with things like facial eczema in sheep. If there are solutions to those problems, they're really interested in that. They're pretty cautious about the idea of a genetically engineered ryegrass, which, of course, would, you know, replicate and spread. And that was acknowledged at the committee. There's no way we could stop such a release from spreading across the environment. It would have been extraordinary if they tried to deny that, but they did acknowledge it. And the industry seems to be less interested in that stuff, more interested in the solutions to things like pests and so forth. And I think that's probably a useful place to have a conversation about what the technology is actually able to do. It relies on things like gene drives, a lot of things that are quite sort of theoretical, haven't been proved. And the main message that we get from scientists who are arguing, the likes of Jack Hindman from Canterbury University, that we need to be really careful with how we do this and take into account all the risks. He says everything has to be done in containment. Even with gene editing, you can achieve transgenesis because the reagents they use to do the gene editing are biological. And so the genome of any new organism created has to be mapped to prove that you haven't actually created a transgenic organism. And then to say the idea that it's substantially equivalent to an organism produced through natural breeding, his sort of argument is that's a somewhat specious concept. So his argument is that everything needs to be done in containment and really thoroughly assessed before release should even be considered.
Mm, sounds fair. Now, on to energy security. Minister Simon Watts has warned of potential winter power outages due to tight electricity supply. And a recent briefing suggests that gas and oil is going to be needed, well, more of it's going to be needed for some time to maintain to maintain stability. Do you think the government is doing enough to ensure energy security while, I guess, very slowly transitioning to renewable energy sources?
Yeah, I mean, I think the term stability is an interesting one because one thing we know is that for us to have a viable planet, we need to have a stable climate, an atmospheric system, and the destabilization of that atmospheric system means extreme weather events more frequent and extreme wildfires and floods and droughts. So that's the problem we're grappling with, is trying to stop the existential threat of climate change, which is why we need to move away from oil, gas and coal, just to remind the Minister of that. And the issue is that over subsequent governments, there's been a real failure to thoroughly reform the energy system and the energy market, which has been a handbrake on proper investment in renewables, basically. New Zealand, if we'd spent the last 10 or 20 years sort of overbuilding renewable energy, wind and solar, we could be in a position now where we're substantially electrifying our energy system, both transport but also industrial energy, so that we're not so dependent on gas and oil and coal. But we're in the situation now where the government is still not fully backing the strategies that are going to achieve sufficient renewable energy supply. And, you know, they've tanked the electric car market. They're not investing in electric public transport. They don't have any strategy for solarisation of households or public hire or schools. They've just totally taken the country in the wrong direction from an energy security point of view, but also from an affordability point of view, because renewable energy is the cheapest form of energy.
The report that Minister Simon Watts has come out and spoken about has stated that electricity demand could increase by up to 170% in the next 25 years, so by 2050. What should the government be doing now to ensure we have enough renewable infrastructure in place to meet this a huge increase in demand?
One of the obvious things would be to break up the generator retailers. Currently, we have this sort of hegemony of the market where the gen retailers benefit from there being fossil fuels in the mix because they can then sell what most of our electricity is in this country is already renewable. They get to sell the hydro at a much higher price if there's also coal being used at the time. That's just an absolutely terrible market structure that is the reality of New Zealand's energy system. They need to be willing to intervene in that structure, and neither Labor nor National are willing to do that. That's the bullet they need to bite. At the same time, there needs to be an energy plan which involves significant increase in renewable energy builds, you know, making sure that year on year the energy companies are building a certain amount of new renewables. And we, for example, in the Greens, had an energy household payment basically grant that we would give to households for $30,000 to solarise and put in place the likes of batteries. And that would have allowed tens of thousands of New Zealand homes to become sort of energy independent, but also feed their electricity back into the grid when it wasn't being used to help give us greater resilience and distributed electricity.
Mm. The Greens have strongly advocated for renewables, but major projects often face delays due to environmental regulations and consenting processes. How could or should Aotearoa streamline renewable energy development without compromising environmental protections?
Yeah, I mean, it's an important thing you have to taking into account all these things, I was involved in getting the Makara West Wind project up. Greenpeace supported that when I was part of Greenpeace back in 2005. And there was opposition to that as well because it has environmental impact. But I think, you know, if you have appropriate kind of resource consenting processes and you involve iwi and hapu and take into account te tiriti and local community, you can get these things across the line. In fact, one of the sort of dishonesties of what the electricity sector say is that they can't build things because of constraints on consents. In fact, most of them have sat on consented wind farms for years and years and years and not built them. So there's actually projects that have not gone ahead only because the company have decided not to build the project, even having got a consent. So it's a slightly, you know, borderline argument. Things like solar are much easier to do if you're using the real estate of rooftops, which are, you know, everywhere in people's houses, on businesses, on public buildings.
Now, just on the wind farm development, has the government's decision to open up oil and gas exploration off the coast of Aotearoa impacted people's willingness to put wind farms out off the shore?
Yeah, we've now had a second major kind of wind farm, offshore wind farm player exit New Zealand because of uncertainty around the government's strategy in terms of Taranaki offshore. There's three things at play there. One is the oil and gas industry. The second one is the deep sea mining industry. That's the sort of home of one of the nastiest kind of zombie projects of the fast track process, which is the Trans-Tasman Resources seabed mining, you know, 50 million tons of sand dredged up each year and dumped back, creating this huge plume. So, for example, the fishing industry spent 10 years working with local iwi and the likes of Greenpeace to oppose that seabed mining because they saw it as terrible for their industry. But also the offshore wind industry said, you can't disturb the seafloor in that manner and it still be viable for us to put wind turbines out there. So you've got to pick what you're going to do.
Yes.
And the government has basically chosen that they prefer to see if they can get some seabed mining happening than some wind farms happening.
Yuck. Oh, man, that sucks. Steve Abel from the Green Party, thank you so much for chatting to us this morning. We'll look forward to speaking with you in a couple of weeks' time.
Awesome. Great talk. See you soon.
That was What's Up with Steve Abel from the Green Party.